Well, ladies and gentlemen, it's a very great pleasure to welcome you to the Lady Chapel on behalf of the Dean and Chapter. This is almost the culminating moment in our festival, fortnight's festival, celebrating the 500th anniversary of the consecration of this chapel. It was consecrated, of course, in February, but we began this process a couple of weeks ago with a Requiem Mass in here for Henry VII, who was so influential, of course, in the decision to build this chapel and is buried just behind me. And then we've had a wonderful concert of Marian music enabling people to come in and wander around the chapel. And this is the third of three lectures, a lecture on the architecture of the chapel, a lecture on Lady Margaret Beaufort, the mother of King Henry VII. And now it seemed to me that the influence of James I on this chapel was considerable in various ways. And I thought it would be excellent to have a chance to explore that influence and the relationship. So this evening, James I, the Abbey, and the beauty of holiness. I think James I is a generally much underrated figure in our history. So I look forward very much indeed to hearing what Andrew Foster has to say. Dr. Andrew Foster is an historian of early modern English history, specializing in ecclesiastical history. He's currently working on a book on the diocese of early modern England and Wales from about 1540 to 1700. And Andrew worked for 30 years at what's now become the University of Chichester and was latterly its director of research. For over 16 years, he's run the Chichester Centre for Ecclesiastical Studies. He's a visiting fellow of the Universities of Southampton and Kent and a fellow of the Royal Historical Society, fairly recently elected a vice president, and a fellow of the Society of Antiquaries of London. More recently, he's been elected to the National Council of the Historical Association. So who better? And it's a pleasure to welcome him to give this last lecture in our short series celebrating the 500th anniversary of the consecration of the Lady Chapel. And there will be a chance at the end, Andrew has agreed, for any who'd like to ask the odd question, to have a go. But now, warmly welcome, please, Andrew Foster.
Thank you very much for that warm introduction
and rather fulsome introduction. Good evening, ladies and gentlemen. I hope I'm wired for sound that's sufficient to get right to the back. That's right, good. Thank you very much for coming to this talk this evening, and my thanks also to the Dean and his colleagues for inviting me to play a part in these splendid celebrations to mark the history of this chapel. As you just heard, this is the last in the three talks in this series. And if you came last week, you'll have heard Christopher Wilson discuss the design and building of the chapel and the marvels of the woodwork and the sculpture that we see around us. Also last week, Richard Rex spoke about Lady Margaret Beaufort, one of those great women in history, mother of Henry VII, great patroness of learning, and founder of not one, but two Lady Margaret Chairs of Divinity. Now, I know already from some of my group of friends who've come with me, you may be wondering, and forgiven for wondering, how does my talk fit in? The Dean has just given part of the story away, but it covers people and events long after the time of Henry VII and Margaret Beaufort and the building of this chapel. And given the events of the English Reformation, it also covers a rather different place or institution. For the Abbey in 1603 was very distinctive, as of course it still is. A Protestant collegiate cathedral, a royal peculiar, with a dean and 12 canons, responsible already for a distinguished school and a number of estates, including a summer retreat at Chiswick. All appointments were in the control of the Crown, even if mediated by the High Steward of Westminster. This changed situation gives one quick explanation as to why our focus has shifted from a dead and buried Henry VII, beautifully entombed as we can see, to the role and impact of James I. Now all I have to do is to convince you that his reign between 1603 and 1625 is actually quite important in the history of this chapel, and indeed a significant watershed for the history of the Abbey and indeed for the Church of England as a whole. I hope this will not prove too difficult a task, but the average visitor to the Abbey can be forgiven for not knowing much about what I'm about to say. I don't wish to give offence, but the history that we all carry in our heads is a strange mixture of facts, half-truths, myths and legends, Mr. Gove, please note. Baggage we may have acquired from school days, Nick Gibb, please note. Old textbooks, films, TV, odd visits to museums and stately homes. It will comprise of some material we know very well, and some material that is frankly probably woefully out of date. Visitors to this abbey may be excused for wandering around in a daze for much of the time, finding odd points of illumination as they come across names and events that they dimly recognize. With this thought in mind, I hope today to challenge a few images that you may have of this period, and in the process, comment on, reassess, or at least plant a few doubts about the general reputations of Queen Elizabeth I, James I, his chief advisor, Sir Robert Cecil, and some of the key deans of Westminster, like Lancelot Andrews, John Williams, and my friend, Richard Neal. I say my friend because this was where I started my historical research many years ago, pursuing the life of Richard Neal, who began his clerical career here as Dean of Westminster in 1605 and ended up as Archbishop of York in 1632. I still remember my first nervous encounter with the large door to the library in the cloisters. I hope all of you are familiar with the cloisters, where you speak into an intercom very close up against the stone, and maybe it will creak open to the amazement of passers-by, like something out of a Harry Potter movie, revealing steep stone stairs to the library above. And I was fortunate to find here a wonderful library and archive, or muniments, as they say here, now looked after so well by Tony Trowles and Matthew Payne. Standing here, where my now alter ego Neil must have stood on many occasions, is very strange, to say the least. So you'll have to indulge me. If I suddenly adopt a pontifical voice, you'll know something's going wrong. But this is not just a story about monarchs, bishops, and deans. I shall also draw attention to a host of other people, ordinary canons of Westminster, like Henry Caesar, Hadrian Saravia, Christopher Sutton, musicians like the organist and composer Edmund Hooper or Thomas Dalham, the most celebrated organ builder of his day. Artists like Maximilian Colt and Cornelius and William Cure, wonderful sculptors whose work surrounds us today. For the story I want to fashion this evening cuts across subject boundaries and includes many important strands concerning music, liturgy, art, court politics, theology, scholarship, and ceremony. And all of these strands need to be brought together if we're to understand the full significance of what happened here at Westminster Abbey under James I. Before I go much further, though, let me comment on the space that we're in today, this chapel. This has always been a curious mixture of a royal mausoleum, a chapel for worship, a tourist site, and a space for public events. Under James I, it was radically altered, filled even by the appearance of several key tombs on either side of us. Most notably, those for Queen Elizabeth I, and Mary, Queen of Scots. There are also the two for the princesses, Sophia and Mary. In the reign of James I, however, this was an important symbolic space, made more so than ever by his own final funeral resting place next to Henry VII, and his insistence that his mother, who was after all Queen of Scotland, should also rest here in the home of English monarchs, and with a slightly grander tomb than that which he provided for the queen who signed her death warrant. And many tourists would have visited this chapel in the 17th century. James I was sufficiently proud of what was happening here that he was persuaded to pay over £60 for the cleaning of various statues, effigies, really, of several of the kings and queens buried here, to be mounted in a kind of exhibition for the state visit of his brother-in-law, King Christian IV of Denmark, in 1606. And he paid the dean a further £50 to cover other costs involved in the visit. This was probably for beer and wine, because the King Christian was a notorious drunkard, and the parties that they had while he was staying here on the state visit do get written up in rather colourful ways. But these were huge payments for the time, I should say, the £60 and the £50. This chapel was also a venue for meetings of convocation. Now, the more usual place was St. Paul's Cathedral, but we know money was spent preparing it for convocation in 1610, and we also know that convocation sat here in 1606. And the abbey had a reputation generally for providing good hospitality when bishops and other senior clergy were in town for meetings of Parliament and convocation. The abbey was an important place of worship for the nobility, a place where visitors came to hear sermons and attend services accompanied by fine music and a full choir. But to return to the issue of reputations, myths, and legends, let me address the common image of James VI and I. The Dean has already alluded to that. He acceded to the throne on the death of Queen Elizabeth in March 1603. His was a peaceful, unchallenged succession, gave him time to travel down to London, receiving petitions galore from an expectant public along the way. But those of you of a certain age will recall the words of Sellar and Yeatman in the immortal 1066 and all that. James I slobbered at the mouth and had favourites. He was thus a bad king. He was seen as timid, lazy, overfond of drink, the horses, and hunting. And worse, he had a fondness for the company of young men. People like his two best-known favourites, Robert Carr, Earl of Somerset, and George Villiers, Duke of Buckingham, who is actually buried, of course, just over there, something that outraged the 19th century Dean Stanley, for he was the first commoner to be buried here. Yet the work of historians in recent years has generally given James I a much better press. So much so that he is now seen as one of our most intelligent and politically astute monarchs, not the wisest fool in Christendom, as was once said. And he was one who was ahead of his time in warning about the dangers of smoking tobacco or talking up the prospects of a happy union between England and Scotland. And obviously he's still ahead of his time on that matter. James I liked to regard himself as a peacemaker, and in many respects he was. He presided over the signing of the Treaty of London in 1604 that brought peace with Spain. He brought leading Roman Catholics like the Howard family in from the cold and onto his Privy Council. He did not overreact to events like the gunpowder plot of 1605 or the later assassination of Henry IV of France in 1610, which sent shockwaves around Europe. He tried to be a peacemaker in Europe. In matters of religion, James I may now be seen to have played a very canny hand. Having handled delicate religious matters in a fiercely divided Scotland, James listened to those with grievances on both Protestant and Catholic sides and tried for a middle course that would allow as many Catholics as possible to sign up to an oath of allegiance, while likewise urging moderate Protestant clergy to sign up to the use of the Book of Common Prayer. The king's response to Puritan traditions about abuses in the church was to hold a conference at Hampton Court in 1604, where he could chair the debate and obligingly lay down the law. Even more significant stamp of royal authority came with 141 canons for the Church of England, passed in Convocation and Parliament that same year, superseding the original 39 articles of 1562. Now, this represented a major codification of what the Church of England was all about. We've only just recently celebrated, in 2011, the masterpiece that bears his name as the King James Authorized Version of the Bible, one really useful product of that Hampton Court conference. And this was work that had strong Westminster connections, for it involved scholars like Lancelot Andrews, leader of one of the companies based here, Thomas Ravis, a canon here, William Barlow, leader of another group here, and Hadrian Saravia. That was a very high number of people from here involved. So perhaps I can plant in your mind another image of James I, that of a tidy king. This also belongs to Seller and Yeatman, actually, but in rather negative terms, for they claimed that because of his very logical and tidy mind, one of the first things he did was to have Sir Walter Raleigh executed for being left over from the previous reign. There were, of course, other reasons, and it wasn't the first thing that he did on coming to the throne. It happened much later. I wish to be slightly more positive, but at the expense of the reputation of his predecessor, Queen Elizabeth. Just as his star has risen with historians, so hers has fallen. She may be known for her wise and judicious Elizabethan settlement, not wishing to make windows into men's souls, but it was James I, as I've just argued with those canons, who really established the Church of England after many years of neglect. In an act passed in 1604, one of his first actions was to stop the practice whereby the crown and courtiers could asset strip the church, seizing property in exchange for less valuable lands and rights. Where Elizabeth had left sees vacant for years, notably Oxford and Ely, and robbed the church consistently, only ever allowing Archbishop Whitgift onto her council, and that towards the end of her reign, James I liked the company of his bishops, valued their role in supporting the state, and employed many of them at court, and employed many of them on his Privy Council. As one contemporary, Thomas Fuller, expressed it, Elizabeth I was like a bad housemaid who swept the problems of her church like dust behind the door. The number of brooms bought regularly by the Abbey in the years after 1603 suggests that a lot more sweeping and cleaning went on after that date. James liked the company of divines and enjoyed the cut and thrust of theological debate. To the despair of many of his courtiers and clerics, he got closely involved in theological debates of the day, chiefly with Catholic controversialists like Cardinal Bellarmine. It was no surprise when James decided to preside over those debates at Hampton Court regarding complaints from those known as Puritans about the need for further reformation, changes to ceremonial seen as tainted with popery, and an emphasis on preaching rather than worship. From the outset of his reign, however, James was quick to reveal his own predilection for order and decency in church worship, keen to emphasize how he wanted his cathedrals in the land, starting here with his own Abbey Peculiar, to act as models of what good Protestant worship might entail. He came to the throne at a convenient moment when a group of theologians, chiefly associated with Cambridge, were questioning some of the harsher tenets of Calvinism, such as double predestination, and urging that greater attention be given to the sacraments, to proper ceremony, and prayer, as opposed to the prevailing heavy emphasis on preaching made so famous at Paul's Cross. All of the King's Deans of Westminster, Lancelot Andrews, Richard Neal, George Mountain, Robert Townsend, and even the more maverick John Williams were associated with this strand of thinking. They were associated with moves to rearrange pews, glorify the altar, conduct services with due reverence, revive a strong choral tradition supported by organs and other musical instruments, and generally beautify the abbey. Lancelot Andrews was the intellectual of this group, rather saintly and otherworldly. George Mountain was apparently something of a buffoon, but hard-working. He signed everything very dutifully, apparently. Robert Townsend was notorious for castigating women in the congregation if they came to services wearing inappropriate clothing, by which apparently he meant yellow ruffs. John Williams was the ultimate political careerist, who became the King's Lord Keeper in 1621. It was Dean Richard Neal, however, who worked so effectively for James in a flurry of activity between 1605 and 1610. James I gave the steer, and people like Neal ensured that something happened. Here is another case where reputations need to be adjusted. For whereas Andrews is known for his work in promoting Westminster School, Williams for the marvelous library and various scholarships that he endowed, it was Neal who first really set about refurbishing the abbey, increasing the pay of the choir, and ensuring that boys had more food to eat, all paid for by shrewd entrepreneurial activities that would put even city folk to shame today. Dean Richard Neal is one of the unsung heroes of this abbey. I've already discussed this with the dean. Yet his portrait is not to be found in any of the corridors of power here. Unlike Andrews and Williams, there's a marvellous portrait of Williams, probably well known to many of you if you've visited the library. As you go up the steps, it's there glowering down at you. Neal was a local boy made good and the first married dean of Westminster. He was the son of a humble tallow chandler born in King Street nearby. Fortunate enough to attend the school as an oppidam or town boy, he was doubly fortunate, for he was not the greatest of scholars. Apparently, the teachers frequently had occasion to cane him as an heavy-headed lubber, as opponents jeered, and as he himself, though, later confessed when he stopped a boy from being caned in Durham. He said it never done him any good, so obvious. Yet he became a playmate of the young Robert Cecil, son of Lord Burghley, the High Steward of Westminster, who had an imposing mansion on the Strand. Thanks to a scholarship given by Lady Mildred Cecil, Neal was sent to St. John's College, Cambridge, when Robert Cecil also went up to Cambridge. The most tangible proof of King James's direct personal engagement in the life of the abbey, though, comes in the tombs that were erected here in the north and south aisles of this chapel. Robert Cecil played a major part in commissioning the artists and workmen, and it's obviously useful that he knew Neal so well. But the notoriously extravagant king paid thousands of pounds over a relatively short period of time to achieve a clear propaganda aim here in the chapel. The first achievement was to move the remains of Queen Elizabeth I from where they'd been first placed, here alongside Henry VII, her grandfather, and to erect a tomb for her over that of her half-sister, Mary, where they could be united at last, and it's just over there, of course, and at least in awaiting the resurrection, as I think the motto actually says. Maximilian Colt, a sculptor originally from Arras, was commissioned to create the monument, for which he was paid quite handsomely and rewarded by being given the new title of Master Sculptor or Carver in 1608. He also carried out work at the Chapel of Greenwich House, but is more famous for the tomb for Robert Cecil that survives at Hatfield. Now, he set a new standard for the times in public sculpture. In that same north aisle, we also have fine monuments to the innocents. Princess Sophia, 1606, only a day old, and Princess Mary, 1607, 1.5 years old, for which Colt created lifelike effigies of great sentimental style and originality, which soon spawned imitations across the country. Great care was clearly lavished on these unexpected and tragic monuments. Yet what was already in the planning stages in 1606 was a much grander monument in the South Aisle to commemorate the king's mother, Mary, Queen of Scots. Executed in 1587 and first buried at Peterborough Cathedral, this represented some sort of closure, we might say today, for the king. It also gave him an opportunity to assert his rights to the throne, which came not only on his mother's side, but also through that of his father, Lord Darnley, also in line from Margaret Beaufort, whose tomb lies above that of his mother. The commission for this tomb was handed to Cornelius Cure, another artist connected with the Cecil family, who was probably responsible for the grand tomb of Lord Burghley that one can find in Stamford in Lincolnshire, near Burghley House, of course. His son, William Cure, completed the work around 1613. What is striking about this tomb is that it is slightly larger than that devoted to Queen Elizabeth, and was accorded glowing tributes composed by Henry Howard, Earl of Northampton, and known probably the leading Catholic, at the court of James I. And it is no accident that rumours soon circulated of miracles occurring at this site. For many still revered Mary as a martyr for her faith, and the only thing stopping appeals for her to be registered as such by later popes being the suspicions of her involvement in the death of her husband, Lord Darnley. It's a sign of the favour in which Richard Neal rejoiced with the king that he was requested to lead the party that went to Peterborough to collect the body in 1612, for he was by then no longer dean, but the Bishop of Coventry and Lichfield. He returned with the body for an evening burial at the Abbey, calculated to arise least notice, but which sounds to have been attended by quite a retinue in the end, a veritable torchlight procession in October 1612. These were effectively the last great royal tombs erected in this chapel. For the sad sudden death of Prince Henry in 1612 saw his remains lodged in a vault beneath his grandmother, while Anne of Denmark, the king's wife, was placed near here by Henry VII in 1619, and James himself here in 1625. Now, those were in vaults. That may not sound very grand, but for James I, it marked the success, if you like, of his propaganda campaign. For he got to lie with Henry VII, while the monuments around him testified to the success of his Stuart family. And his real monument, of course, is just up the road in the marvellous banqueting house built by Inigo Jones and decorated by Rubens, outside of which his son Charles was unfortunately executed in 1649. The tombs mark the physical impact of the king on Westminster. And one expert has claimed that they exerted an influence well beyond the capital. As Adam White has noted, never since the beginning of the English Renaissance had so many and such important innovations been diffused from one building, single building, this building. Time and again, he claims, for key new funeral monuments in churches across the land, the trail leads back to Westminster. Books were published giving details of the monuments. Tourists were coming here in droves. People were taking those images out to their churches. None more so than those actually also in London. Quite a range of tombs, of course, suddenly mimicking the ones that were going on here. But quite a far afield as well, in Lincolnshire, in Hertfordshire, in Essex, all around the country. James I and Robert Cecil were the leading patrons of these artists. But they were also clearly influential in encouraging Richard Neal in the latter's efforts to create a new style of worship here at the Abbey, the precursor for what we might term later the beauty of holiness. As I've already noted, Neal was of humble origins. He owed everything to the Cecil family. And he would not have dared to carry out what he did without the clear backing of his patron, Robert Cecil, Earl of Salisbury, or the King, with whom he seems to have struck up a very close relationship. Neal was the King's clerk of the closet, which may not sound like a grand job, but it gave him control of the Lent preaching schedule. And he held that post, actually, for the longest time of anybody in the 17th century, right the way through to the 30s. This gave him valuable patronage about who came to preach before the court. As a leading royal chaplain, Neal often accompanied the King to services. And it has been alleged by hostile witnesses that if he feared a sermon was waxing too evangelical for comfort, he would crack dirty jokes to put the King off listening. This is absolutely true, contemporary witness. He once joked sarcastically of the famous Puritan divine John Preston that he preached as if he was at the right hand of God Almighty. As you might imagine, Puritan contemporaries did not take kindly to Neal, nor have generations of Whig historians since. The best that early Abbey historians could say of him was that he was a wise and wary man. One historian concluded rather reluctantly that, like all villains, he was not all bad. I don't think that's been said about many deans, Westminster. Worse than that, though, William Prynne, the man who had his ears cut off in the 1630s, later claimed that Neal had died deliberately in 1640 to avoid execution, like his friend Laud. Now, this does seem a bit harsh, because he was 78 at the time, but it shows you the sort of venom that William Prynne could conjure up. Neal was very fond of ceremony and the sacraments, and one of his first acts was to preside over the remodeling of the pews for the choir to ensure an uncluttered view of the altar. He also spent hundreds of pounds on new altar cloths made of elaborate material and fine colours. Over his 5 years as dean, nearly £300 was spent in providing gold and silver communion plate, cups, basins, and patterns. And we know of the King's personal involvement in this project because the King and Queen gave some of the cloth provided for the altar at their coronation. Others were also encouraged to swing behind these endeavours, such as William Camden, the famous antiquarian and one-time teacher at Westminster School. He provided a silver basin and ewer worth £3. To reinforce the image of Neal as a practical administrator, however, he also provided an iron cradle or brazier for the fire to keep people warm during their services. This concern that everything should be carried out with due reverence and order was absolutely typical of Neal, and also a hallmark of what we may later refer to, as I've said, the beauty of holiness, espoused in the 1630s when Neal was Archbishop of York and his friend William Laud was Archbishop of Canterbury. Now, throughout his life, Neal demonstrated great interest in fine church music, and this was something in which he was no doubt influenced by his childhood experience of Westminster. Under Dean Gabriel Goodman, Westminster had remained a haven for fine worship and good music at a time when many churches in the country, including many cathedrals, were losing their organs under pressure from Puritans who preferred psalms to anthems. Encouraged again by the King, who spoke before convocation in 1606 about his love of church music and choral singing, in which he hoped his cathedrals would set a pattern, Neil set about improving choral music here at Westminster, and that royal speech may well have been given in this very chapel. Neil's methods were simple: bribery. He raised the wages of the choir, of the master of choristers, and the organist. And the latter two posts were separated in 1606, possibly to give Edmund Hooper, the noted organist and composer, more time for his work, leaving the discipline of the choir, which had been noted as lax in 1603, to a new master of choristers, John Gibbs. More significant still, Neil improved the food diet of the choir, spending an extra £31 over 4 years before 1610. But to put that in perspective, and perhaps a backhanded comment on his own experience as a boy here at Westminster School, he spent an extra £1,290, so keep adding some noughts, over his five-year period of office on improving the meals provided for all the masters and pupils. Not content with these changes, and here is perhaps a mark of the man of humble origins, he paid for a fine set of service books for the choir, bound with brass clasps and embossed with the college arms. And he also set out, built a cupboard for the amazing amount of music that was now being assembled. Again, we may see Westminster, therefore, as in the forefront of major changes, this time in terms of the history of music. This argument is strengthened when we consider that the famous organ makers, the father and son combination of Thomas and Robert Dalham, both worked for Westminster in this period. A new organ was purchased for this chapel, and anthems were sung here every day. The Dalhams were responsible for keeping this and the main organ in the loft tuned and maintained, for which they received annual salaries. I'd like also, though, to know about a man, George Pendleton, who was here before Dalham, but about whom I can find very little at the moment. Most significantly, however, over the course of the next 40 years, Thomas and Robert Dalham were responsible for an organ renaissance across the land. Thomas had already built a new organ for King's College, Cambridge, in 1656, but he went on to construct organs for Norwich, Wells, Bristol, and Durham cathedrals, not to mention one at Hatfield House for the Cecils, St. George's Chapel, Windsor, Eton College, and perhaps most controversially, Holyrood House in Edinburgh. On his death around 1630, his son Robert picked up the baton and proceeded to build organs for St. John's College, Cambridge, Lichfield, and Gloucester cathedrals. And he returned to do more after the Restoration. All of the organists of Westminster Abbey from this period have merited entries in the famous Oxford Dictionary of National Biography. The Abbey shared the services of many of the choir with the Chapel Royal. Also associated with the Abbey, I've not mentioned the illustrious Orlando Gibbons, probably the most famous musician of the early modern. Also associated, William Heather, a lay clerk here, a gentleman again of the Chapel Royal, a founder of a music lecture at Oxford that bears his name to this very day. I think I can safely rest my case on this and leave more comment to the musicologists amongst you. All of this was accomplished by a Westminster team of clergy and officials, already well trained in running the Abbey, happy to follow the King's lead and to comply with the wishes of his deans. One thinks here of canons like Hadrian Saravia, eminent refugee scholar who worked on the new Bible and wrote at length in defense of episcopacy. William Barlow, the author of the influential account of the Hampton Court Conference, who went on to become Bishop of Rochester and then to Lincoln. Christopher Sutton was a noted sacramentalist who wrote about the importance of taking communion regularly. The more often a Christian doth repair to the Holy Communion, the greater is his perfection. and the nearer he doth come to the piety of ancient Christians, he said. And Henry Caesar, renowned for exporting his love of music to Ely, where he became dean in 1614, but perhaps more famous as possibly, and I quote again from the Oxford Dictionary of National Biography, and I look to the dean for this for confirmation or not, the only canon of Westminster featured in the history of a secret service. He worked as a spy for Walsingham when on the continent. I don't know whether any canons have that claim to fame. Westminster Abbey in the early 1600s was a lively and influential place to be. I have just picked out a few of the canons that shared Neil's concern for proper worship and proceeded to spread the message to cathedrals and dioceses throughout the land. We might also consider the presence here of Canon Richard Hakluyt, famous geographer and author of the Principal Navigations. The heads of Oxford and Cambridge colleges, like John Holt from Corpus Christi and Nicholas Bond from Magdalen. And of course, there was always the famous antiquarian and author I've already mentioned, William Camden, whose funeral in 1623 was almost royal in attracting the great and the good to this abbey. It is thus little wonder that our illustrious Reverend Professor Sir Dermot MacCullet has suggested that we might refer to what happened here at this time as a Westminster movement, akin really to the Oxford movement of the 19th century. And Julia Merritt, another great historian of Westminster, has referred to this place and time as the cradle of Laudianism and drawn attention to the way in which concern for the fabric and fittings of churches spread to others in London. Over 60 London churches were repaired, enlarged, and beautified during the first decades of the 17th century. And again, James led the way, as when he and a group of bishops surveyed the need for restoration work at St. Paul's Cathedral in 1620, which must have galled them when you consider how things were shaping up here by then at Westminster. I shouldn't perhaps push that point too far, because there was a lot of connection between St. Paul's Cathedral and Westminster, and many canons held places in both. More could be said about how the Westminster effect was disseminated across London, carried out into the diocese by bishops like Ravis and Barlow, to places like Gloucester, London, Rochester, Lincoln, and how the musical establishment was so interlinked here in the capital, and how here seemed to be the hub, not only the Chapel Royal. Certainly, Neil carried the torch for this kind of work in all of his six dioceses. And by his time as Archbishop of York in the 1630s, the beauty of holiness came to encompass church restoration work across the whole country. Reverence for altars, the fitting of communion rails, appreciation of fonts, bowing to the altar and at the name of Jesus, as well as strict adherence to the use of the Book of Common Prayer and encouragement again of fine music and art in churches. I could go on, but I shall rest content if I've succeeded in giving you some new images this evening. A more significant James I than you might have imagined, the Machiavellian Sir Robert Cecil employing patronage of the arts in his political machinations, a different slant on some of the deans, most notably entailing a better appreciation of my practical friend, Richard Neal, and an awareness of how liturgy and church worship that we tend to associate with the 1630s may have actually started here at Westminster Abbey in the early 1600s, an influence that is with us to the present day. Thank you for listening.
Thank you very much. Questions? Let me fascinated by the Cecil relationship with Richard Neal. Of course, the earlier Cecil with
William,
with Gabriel Goodman,
yes,
as well, from 1561 to 1601. I'm fascinated by two questions, really. One, what the ceremony would have been like and how far it connected to Western, what you might call Western rites, how far it had developed on its own front. And, of course, we see Lordian frontals being very different from from the sort of frontals we've got here now. We've got a Lordian frontal in the nave. The other is, just briefly perhaps, just to confirm, you were talking about James, as it were, having a plan in relation to the chapel and to the burials here. The plan, I take it, was this necessary to establish himself successfully as king in England? Was that part of it?
Yes, I mean, but let's take the first one before I come back to that one and remind me in a minute. But you're quite right that a crucial factor, and it became apparent to me as I was working on this talk, and thank you very much for giving me the topic in this way, because it caused me to look again at material that is a long time ago and which I'd put in a certain way, a frame, about the career of Neil, but hadn't looked at in terms of that very important connection with James. But equally, before that, the Gabriel Goodman longevity from 1561 right the way through to 1603, the crucial role that he played for Elizabeth, in a sense, in making sure that this place was safe for a certain type of worship, then led me to think about an investigation. I don't know, Tony and Matthew may know, but whether scholars have gone looking very carefully at some of the Westminster boys who went up to Oxford and Cambridge, and how many of those end up later in that early Arminian movement of this, well, come through to the 1630s, because they were influenced by the nature of worship being maintained here in Westminster Abbey, and the only place where probably they got that kind of worship. And so Gabriel Goodman might become another hero for me in terms of deans who really did leave their mark, although he's often seen as a very conservative tradition. Well, of course, that would be his position. But and he was never promoted, of course. And the argument goes that Elizabeth wanted it safely here in Westminster and wanted to keep him here. Coming back to James, yes, I think I don't go as far as some of the people who've done a lot of work on the funeral monuments, and I'm not a great expert. Some say that he had a kind of an image was that side, the north side, should be the sterile side, and that this side, the south side, would be the fertile side. And the sterile side is Elizabeth, and the fertile side is the Stuarts. And so I think that you can get quite carried away in some of this. How far? I think he had a plan. I think it's very interesting that he moved Elizabeth from here and created that tomb over Mary and put the two sisters together. But equally, it's obviously then sad that the two youngsters, but those are incredible tombs and were very advanced for their time and did have a lot of influence out in the provinces. Of course, you can tell me in a sense that the chapel has the name of the Chapel of the Innocents in a sense at that side, but it's the Innocents, as in the two princes and the tower, only come there in 1678. Just, yeah. So it's not. It's the Innocents are in fact Sophia and Mary, I think. But as to what plans he had, he certainly wanted. I think he wanted to be there, and he got there, and he didn't need the big monument, and he had obviously the banqueting house.
His son gave him no monument at all.
No.
Now, do we have a roving light?
There's a curious paradox about James I's burial. As you said, he was very keen to be buried next to Henry VII, and indeed he was. And then it seemed that it became an almost forgotten fact that he was there, because the story is that until Dean Stanley reopened the tomb in the mid-19th century, although people knew that James was somewhere in the Abbey, where exactly he was had been long, long obliterated by the passage of time. How do you account for the fact that somebody who was obviously so important for this particularly beautiful chapel could have become, in a sense, so ironically forgotten over the centuries until rediscovered almost three centuries later?
Well, some of that goes back to what I would call the Whig tradition in history, from which we get the delightful Sellers and Yeatman, 1066 and all that. because obviously he was seen as the start of the stupid Stuarts, followed by his even stupider son, who managed to get himself executed. And the whole story of British history, the way it's been written, is that James is seen as this buffoon, tongue-tied, you know, not a competent monarch at all. And it's only in comparatively recently, it's about the last 25 years or so, that people like Jenny Wormald, Pauline Croft, and others have said, look, here was a man who ruled actually quite well in Scotland. He can't have suddenly become an incompetent. A lot more people are then looking at what he did. And people like Ken Fincham and Peter Lake and others have talked about his role in establishing ecclesiastical policy, where he did have a very clear plan. He wanted to separate out the extremists. He wanted a united church. He kept a united church. The person who knocked his church off balance was Charles I, who immediately allied with one wing of the church, namely this high church or Arminian wing. And that is said to be, of course, one of the causes of the English Civil War. Because when you get... Charles II later. But then the Whig history then comes, that these silly tyrannical Stuarts caused all the problems and gave us the Civil War. And then luckily Parliament rescues us, and they get another story about how wonderful Parliament is. But... Absolutely. You can do it better than I.
The key thing, obviously, as you know, but most people don't, and of course causes all your tourist problems, is these dead ends of the aisles, because it was only, obviously, in our more recent times, 19th and 20th century and so on here, that the chapel was given its present form. And of course, around the side here, these royal closets, which unfortunately the masonry of the windows has been cut out, if you look at the earlier engravings and so on, and of course at the end here, as I say, it was much more open and without this great monumental altar here. And so what I was wondering was whether how you would describe the actual chapel in James the first time, in terms of presumably the altar was an ordinary table, but do we know anything about that? I'm absolutely ignorant on.
No, I think it would have been a highly decorated table. I think every chapel in this place would have been well looked after in that way. The other question for me is where that organ would be that was built here, and we're assuming that it's probably there. But as you say, I mean, this is a strange building, isn't it, altogether? I mean, one thing we should also be commenting on is, once upon a time, Oliver Cromwell was buried in here alongside Ireton in the chapel just up there. And at that restoration was removed about
1661.
Yeah, all removed carefully and hung out to dry. But what's amazing about this chapel is that it's had in it Cromwell, it also had the Westminster Assembly from 1643 to 1644. So the assembly that was debating what to do about the Church of England was meeting here. And the other thing I want to find out more about is those convocations. Sadly, convocation records are not good. But how many convocations were held here, and whether it was only the upper house of convocation, in other words, the 22 bishops from the southern province who would have been in here, with the lower house in a larger space, and where would that larger space have been? How many spaces are there?
Well, there is a story about convocation meeting in the Jerusalem chamber as well, but that...
And in the chapter house.
But that was much more recently, I think.
Ah.
I don't know, I may be wrong.
Yeah, yeah.
The only other comment, sorry, I would still say, is the music, because I've always assumed the organ, the Dalham organ, was just somewhere on the floor. Obviously, it wasn't small enough to be moved around like a portable one. But I don't think there's any evidence whatsoever there was a West Gallery, or even a structure over the door for an organ up there. But it could have been at that end of the building. But what I was going to go on to say is the other thing that's changed, of course, is the stalls at the end, were all added and hence filled up and blocked the ends of the aisles.
Blocked there, yes.
The break is just here.
Yeah.
This presumably is where the actual singing would have still taken place from, because that's the thing that always disappoints me, is these wonderful stalls, which are, in a way, musical instruments, because, of course, they are deliberately built on enormous sound boxes for the resonance of the singers, don't get used as that. And I presume the anthems and things, you know, that were going on at the time, the singers would have still been here, up to here, obviously no stalls beyond there, and therefore there would have been the wonderful surround sound that one doesn't get, as we had with the service just a couple of weeks ago, when the singers were all tucked away in the corner, rather than, you know, giving us and the banners, which must break up the sound a bit if you had singing here, which of course didn't exist at that time. So I still sort of hanker for the sound, the polyphonic music, 17th century music and so on, sung from the stalls, filling the whole of this fabulous space.
What that also raises when you say about how there would have been more throughways is how it would have sounded with processionals, because that's something a lot more musicians are getting interested in, isn't it? What would it have sounded like in the church and so on? The organ was repaired specifically for Prince Mary's funeral as well. So that suggests it was one you could move in and out. So presumably a smaller portable affair.
When the City of London gave the Queen an organ for her Diamond Jubilee, and she gave it to us on permanent loan, the question was whether we could build it up there. Uh-huh. And we were absolutely clear we couldn't. And there it is in the corner, just here since 2012. And very beautiful instrument it is. Mm-hmm. Now, another question. Yes, sir.
Thank you. I also wanted to comment, though I'm not so sure.
Canon Nicholas, this one.
Yes, I also wanted to comment on a question related to the music. Clearly the link with the Chapel Royal was very important, and we have the impression that it is Elizabeth on the one hand and her successors, the Chapel Royal, and the other foundations like Windsor and the Abbey that are part of that royal setup that sustained this tradition of music in the Reformed Church of England. In one sense, of course, it's not a tradition, because it is a new form of choral music,
the
use of organ with voices, which is the verse anthems, the verse services, which, of course, are a completely new idea. So, in a way, Westminster Abbey and the Chapel Royal are creating a new tradition, and a very wonderful one. What I don't know, and I wonder whether you do, is the extent of the overlap in personnel between the Abbey and the Chapel Royal. We know about organists. I'm not so sure about the gentlemen of the Chapel Royal and the adult singers here.
I think it was considerable, but I think it's a very good question and an area, as I perhaps indicated at the end, where more research is needed. I mean, Heather, for example, was both here and the Chapel Royal, and there were various others. I'm on the search of more information about John Gibbs, and John Gibbs moves from being the Master of the Choristers here in 1613 and goes to St. Paul's. That's not been picked up, as far as I can tell, in the St. Paul's history. But he dies then in 1621. But what's interesting there is that St. Paul's, if you read their own account, is said to be in the doldrums in musical terms in this period. And it's Westminster that clearly is leading the way. So the fact that John Gibbs goes there to lead the choir, I think, is interesting, and possibly some of the shared personnel that would have been there. But in this area, actually, this particular neighbourhood, I think Julia Merritt discovered that quite a lot of the musicians seem to live in this area, and that there was a lot of camaraderie about it in terms of what they were doing. But the other thing is, of course, it's the other instruments as well, the viols and the sackbuts and others. So it's not just, not just the organ. The other feature that's still a bit debatable about the organ is whether it was being used at some earlier stages more as a voluntary and a guide, not as accompaniment. So the development of the anthems with accompaniment in that way may come later. But I'm not a musicologist, so you've got me rail out on a limb at this point.
Well, I think we should draw this to a close. What I'm fascinated by is the thought that Hooper, whom you mentioned, is still on the repertoire. His Magnificat and Magnanimitas were sung yesterday evening.
Wonderful.
At Evensong, Gibbons, all the other musicians who served here. And I absolutely love the fact that we have this continuous musical tradition going back through our history. I'm also fascinated by what you were saying. I knew about Lancelot Andrews and the others a little bit in terms of liturgical revival, but the thought of a whole Westminster movement ahead of the Oxford movement various ideas.
Yeah.
But also a reflection, because Dean Stanley, before mentioned, who's buried just there and managed as a poor cleric to creep in here, was of course at the forefront of the broad church movement.
Yes.
In the 19th century, when St. Paul's was high church. So there we are. We continue to be, you know, ourselves. But this has been a fascinating lecture, and we're in your debt. And thank you so much indeed.
Thank you. Thank you very much.